You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, if I can have your attention. I'm Jessica Matthews, the president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you here on this balmy day to join with me in welcoming officially in the non-governmental sector, to welcome India's new ambassador to the United States, and to have the chance to be part of hearing his first public address since coming to Washington. If I may, before introducing him, I just like to give a few remarks about Carnegie and India. Obviously, India is one of the world's major powers and a country and in a region for which there are virtually no issues that we concern ourselves with, for which India is not an absolutely key part of the solution. We're hoping that in the next coming year that the words New Delhi will be on this in this list, and as we open a new office in India. And I'm very proud of both the longstanding relationship between Carnegie and the Indian government and Indian civil society. And we're very much looking forward to continuing that relationship with Ambassador Jaishankar during his tenure in Washington. Carnegie has a deep history of research on India that we're excited to be building on in this really crucial year for India and for India's future, with our India Decides 2014 project. We're doing a series of articles in which we're analyzing the likely impact of the India's national elections on the country's economy, its domestic policies, and its foreign relations. I'm sure many of you have seen much of that writing on our website already. And to coincide with the immediate post-election period, the new government taking office, we will be publishing a major book entitled Getting India Back on Track, an Action Agenda for Post-Election Reform. The book is edited by Ashley Tellis and Bibek Debroy, and it brings together 17 of India's top policy practitioners and thinkers to talk about each one a very tightly focused chapter. What are the top priorities for the coming 5 years? So this is very much not a kind of a blue sky discussion, but a very hard-headed attempt to say what is the immediate action agenda, as the title suggests. And both of these projects are meant to reflect our assessment of the importance of South Asia in general and India in particular, for the solution of the world's major economic and geopolitical and environmental and security issues. Overseeing this in Washington now, Ambassador Jaishankar is coming immediately from a posting in Beijing. As I look back over his diplomatic career, which started in foreign postings in Moscow, it's sort of followed very much practically the course of our of Carnegie's own international network. He's returning to Washington after an earlier posting. He has also served in Japan and in Eastern Europe, as well as in many positions in the foreign ministry in Delhi. He comes with a very close relationship and portfolio from the Prime Minister, and I think talking to him will be a major figure in the diplomatic corps here, and able to move forward one of the most important bilateral relationships in the world. So we are honored to have you here, and very honored to host your first public address since arriving. Very pleased to have all of you here, and I look forward both to ambassador's talk and to a very vigorous Q&A afterwards. So let me turn the podium over to Ambassador Jaishankar.
I'll just carry my glass of water.
Oh, sorry.
Thank you, Jessica. Well, I'll try to live up to that billing. But really, it's a great pleasure to be back at the Carnegie Endowment, as indeed in Washington itself. I was last here more than 6 years ago. And in fact, I was speaking at the Carnegie Endowment then, at a time when our nuclear agreement was nearing its conclusion. Since then, I have watched the India-US relationship evolve with great interest from different postings, and frankly, with some sense of ownership. The size of the briefing books that they gave me in Beijing as I was preparing to come out to Washington led me to believe that we have a good story to tell. Sentiment, as they say in the markets, however, seems a little less positive than I had hoped for a variety of reasons. So what is very clear to me is that there is much work to be done. Looking back at the growth of Indo-US relations in the last decade and a half, it is as if we were fated to come together. Now, that's not always been our history. If we closely examine the three key drivers of our ties today, the reality is that each one has a specific context. First and foremost is our geostrategic and political convergence, something that could manifest itself only after the end of the Cold War. The second is our intersecting economic interests. Now, these are the consequence of higher Indian economic growth rates, as well as the broader rise of Asia. The third is a mix of our shared values and societal contacts. These reflect the expanding Indian-American community and the growing middle class in India. Each one of these factors has evolved over a period of time, but their coming together created the basis for the current phase of our ties. It is not as if all of this happened on its own. On the contrary, the new level of our relationship was animated by strategic vision in both nations. Prime Minister Manmohan Singh only recently singled out the coming together of the two countries in the form of the civilian nuclear agreement as the best moment of his tenure. This vision becomes reality due to the commitment and diligence on the part of many on both sides. I stress this to drive home the point that our ties can neither afford dilution of attention nor weakening of faith. So, where are our relations today? Politically, there's no question that our comfort levels are higher than they have ever been before. From the highest levels of the government to the legislature and the bureaucracy, we see a frequency, intensity, and candor of contacts that speak for themselves. Our dialogues have moved well beyond orthodox stock-taking or bilateral issues and an exchange of views on global ones. We are now talking defense cooperation, counterterrorism, and homeland security with as much ease as we were energy, education, or health. That we discussed East Asia regularly reflects our confidence levels as much as our doing trilateral dialogues with Japan and with Afghanistan. Expanding such conversations to cover the Indian Ocean region is the next step in that direction. Our economic interactions have similarly undergone a transformation. A greater sectoral focus and engagement on specific policies and regulations underline that this is for real. Where civil society is concerned, the physical flow of people has been magnified by virtual communications. There is truly cause for satisfaction about the level where our ties have reached. Why then is there a problem of sentiment? The fact is that to a considerable degree, we are victims of our own success. The India-US relationship arrived, some would say at last, And by doing so, ended the romance of the phase of courtship. The change is visible in the less integrated approach we take, leaving each department or agency to handle its counterpart. That no longer allows the luxury of cutting some slack on one account, expecting to make up elsewhere. The willingness to take risks also decreases as there is no longer a great cause to pursue. And grand strategy, once achieved, I'm afraid quickly changes from rocket science to a no-brainer. As we settle into the partnership, it takes a different mindset to address the less exciting chores of maintenance, upkeep, and progress. The danger here is that individual problems that may well have been dismissed in the earlier era can now dominate the narrative. This explanation, however, doesn't suffice in itself. There is also the reality, often glossed over when it comes to our ties, that the world situation has changed profoundly even as the relationship was in the making. I refer here to the 2008 financial crisis and its aftermath. This has had a particularly sharp impact on American priorities and with some time lag on India as well. Conversations have changed from grand strategy and geopolitics to more mundane issues of market access and investment conditions. Economic concerns assume center stage, and every business dispute has acquired a greater resonance. As it was bound to happen, this has also created fertile ground for sometimes exaggerating the nature of problems and their implications. The big change I see returning to this account is the salience of tax disputes, localization, and IP concerns on the American end, and immigration reform, market access, protectionism, and totalization on the Indian one. I'm also aware that there is considerable disappointment that our nuclear understanding has not translated into substantial business for U.S. companies so far. The debate, as many of you know, revolves around our civil nuclear liability law and its implications. There are discussions underway on how this issue can be addressed to the satisfaction of suppliers and recipients alike, taking into account the Indian legal and regulatory framework as well as the international convention. The nuclear initiative has surmounted past challenges, and speaking from experience, it must be approached with a positive spirit. Let me make another point in this context that is often overlooked. I recall Prime Minister Manmohan Singh telling Secretary Kerry, then a US senator, that our nuclear differences were a thorn stuck in the throat of our relationship. By reaching an understanding, the way was cleared for a much warmer relationship between us. To my mind, the indirect benefits flowing from the India-US civil nuclear agreement outweigh the direct ones. Another issue that has dampened sentiment somewhat was our not choosing an American supplier for our medium multi-role combat aircraft. As someone involved in the initial phase of that exercise, let me say frankly that the process difficulties at the U.S. end and the challenge of creating a template for a country like India were factors. There was also a sense of entitlement on the American side, which the last time I checked is the prerogative of the customer. Subsequent events have disproven the political inferences that many drew from that episode. The Indian Air Force today is second only to the U.S. Air Force in its fleet of C-17 Globemaster heavy lift aircraft. The Indian Navy has introduced the P-8 Poseidon maritime surveillance aircraft at the same time as did the U.S. Navy. We have just cleared an additional order of C-130J Super Hercules aircraft. Unlike many other recipients of American military hardware, India actually pays for these acquisitions. Nor does India ever give cause for technology protection concerns. It is also encouraging that an India-specific acquisition and co-production template is now under development in the Pentagon. The rest of the defense relationship is doing well, too. The U.S. is the country with which our armed forces conduct the maximum number of exercises. These, I might add, have been growing in complexity. This year, India would be a full participant in the RIMPAC exercises for the first time, deploying naval assets in that regard. Our policy dialogues and military exchanges have also grown in their frequency and comfort level. Having said that, I would still underline that geostrategic convergence is the core of our relationship, even if it is more circumspectly expressed in day-to-day diplomacy. Looking across the global expanse, our concerns overlap to a large extent, as do sources of our threat. As a result, our national security structures are engaged in the broadest possible sense. Even as the US recovers economically and strategically, the case for working with India has only gotten stronger. There is a broad consensus in this town that any future security strategy has to be more partnership-based. To our West, there are uncertainties arising out of the 2014 drawdown scenario from Afghanistan and its consequences. To our East, maritime claims and disputes have heightened tension in the Indo-Pacific region. Overall, Asia has become politically more volatile, yet economically more central. How India's look east policy meets the US rebalancing will have a significance beyond our individual interests. In addressing that and other pressing challenges, we would serve each other's interests best by being ourselves. After all, India and the United States do have a common commitment to a peaceful, pluralistic, and progressive world. And no one should dispute that as a liberal democratic society, India's rise poses no challenge to American values. In the nearer term, our diplomats and strategists are naturally confronted with a myriad of issues of international politics. We seem to agree on many, but differ on some. That should not be surprising, as our broad political and security goals are not in contradiction. At the same time, we must also acknowledge that our experiences, understanding, and interests are not identical. Differences can, of course, be played up by a constituency pushing a particular cause. There is also the temptation to be transactional under pressure. On the issues of economic development, we cannot ignore the plain truth that we have very different situations at home. This makes us often sit on opposite sides of the table. It is important to understand that negotiations on some of the more difficult issues are independent of our bilateral ties. At the end of the day, our overall relationship is larger than the individual problems we examine and debate. Having said that, it is also important we resist calls to return to the arguments of the past. The current phase of our ties came about precisely because there was a more acute understanding of the growing weight and potential of India by the United States. That must continue if we are to forge ahead. Our economic cooperation is based on a counterpart of this broad vision. This has allowed the relationship to foster an exchange of goods, capital, and services, and build new constituencies of support. Trade has quadrupled to $100 billion in the last 7 years. American investments in India have crossed the $50 billion mark. India, I should add, is probably about half that. While putting behind us the famous description of economic cooperation being as flat as a chapati, we do have to contend today with the compulsions of the post-2008 era. As a result, we are now entering a period that established partners of the United States are more familiar with, but which is still a novel experience for us Indians. Let me make four big points here. One, we do recognize that the slowdown in India is not just the result of the global crisis. Reviving growth through increasing investment is our foremost priority. An empowered committee has cleared 286 stalled infrastructure projects worth $97 billion last year. Our government's fiscal deficit, a serious source of concern, has also been brought down sharply. An improvement in the economic mood back home will surely lift our bilateral interactions. Two, India is concerned about its reputation, and we mean to act to show that we are open to international business. That is evident from the recent announcement of safe harbor rules, the clarification of transfer pricing regulations, efforts at limiting the impact of the preferential market access policy for IT and telecom on private sector, and maintaining the 100% FDR limit on brownfield pharmaceutical acquisitions. An important mechanism to discuss and resolve tax disputes has been reactivated and will be meeting in Washington next fortnight. And discussions on the bilateral investment treaty are also set to resume very shortly. 3, we could continue a public argument on trade and investment issues. Both sides have their own narrative of woes. Or move to a more constructive, if less public, dialogue. In my early contacts with the administration, I have made clear our preference is for the latter. But if presented with the former, I fear that as naturally argumentative people, we could well be tempted to respond in kind. 4, on some issues, we need to find an acceptable compromise because the fact is we are coming at it from very different places. The pharmaceutical business is a good example, and triangulating affordability, profits, and respect for intellectual property is a challenge that merits more consideration. Since the economy is now so central to our ties, I would also like to make it very clear that India's interests warrant supporting an early American recovery. Not enough credit has been given to the investments that Indian companies have made here, especially since 2008. A recent study of 68 Indian companies revealed that their collective investments in the United States now exceed $17 billion. One-third of them are actively engaged in R&D here, spending $350 million in that respect. Similarly, the Indian aircraft orders that I spoke about earlier alone support 40,000 jobs in the U.S. defense industry. A fair dialogue should also take into account India's priorities and concerns. Here, the bottom line is that the costs of doing business in the United States are systematically under pressure from competitors. A worrying sign is the tendency by some to demonize the business climate in India. This tactic could well end up being counterproductive. You could reasonably ask what I would say about our ties to an Indian audience. To them, I would make two basic points. One, that to realize India's four key priorities, energizing the economy, raising our technology and management capabilities, securing the homeland, and ensuring a favorable balance of power, the United States is the indispensable partner. Two, these big Indian goals are not at odds with the interests of the United States. In fact, this could even be complementary. Relationship building is never without challenges. Some of it is structural. The rest emanates from our different histories. The U.S. has to overcome its inclination to view ties through the lens of alliance practices. Indians perhaps have to indulge themselves less in compulsive ambiguity. Ironically, American complaints on that score usually come when they too are considering hedging. Building ties require a degree of give and take that can test official dumps. Appreciating each other's interests can be more difficult than we generally assume. And contrary to what many seem to believe here, domestic politics is not just the prerogative of the United States. In going about my task as ambassador, I draw support from the vast goodwill that now characterizes the attitudes of our societies to each other. The grand strategy underwriting our ties is fundamentally sound. It needs maintenance and from time to time an upgrade. That puts the emphasis on detailing and problem solving. For those of us who have devoted time and energy to building Indo-US ties, the last few weeks have been truly distressing. What I have encountered since my arrival here is the sense that this situation should have never happened. But since it did, we will now have to work through this problem. That is part of the conversations underway. But what the issue does highlight is the need for greater sensitivity, for better understanding, and for stronger oversight of our ties. I rest my case on that note. Thank you. I think it would be better if I did it from here.
Okay, let me move there. Let me open the floor to questions, and just ask people to identify themselves and to be relatively brief, because given the size of this group, I expect there will be an awful lot of questions. Way in the back.
Namaste, Mr. Ambassador. My name is Neha Mishra, and I'm a lawyer and part of a group here from the AFL-CIO. And I think you can tell from my name and my accent that I'm an Indian American. We would like to ask you two questions about the Devyani Cobra Gadi worker exploitation domestic worker case. The first question is that the response of the Indian government to the indictment of Ms. Cobra Gadi has given the impression that the Indian government is more concerned about a diplomat than the rights of domestic workers, and the domestic worker who was also an Indian citizen, and I'd like to hear your response to that. And I'd also like to ask, do you agree that Indian-U.S. relations can only move forward in a positive way if Indian diplomats respect the U.S. rule of law, including U.S. labor laws that cover and protect domestic workers? And will you enact policies to bring the diplomatic corps into compliance with U.S. labor laws? Thank you.
Maybe it's better I stand there. It's easier to
whichever.
Write.
We'll see.
Well, why does that question surprise me? Okay, look. You know, on the right, you spoke about the rights of the domestic worker and the rights of the diplomat. The fact is that they had a dispute, and the dispute was already under litigation in India. So whatever happened here was an attempt to supersede what was already happening in India, and I think that was not taken too kindly. The second issue you asked me was, should diplomats respect laws? You asked me, should Indian diplomats respect U.S. laws? I would take the liberty of making it into a bigger question. Should all diplomats respect all laws? And my answer would be yes. And I think if you are looking at respecting laws, I think equally American diplomats should respect Indian laws. And that is an issue which is today under discussion. So look, on this issue, let me say this. We clearly have very differing views about immunity. We have very clearly differing views about which one of our diplomats is respecting which law. We have issues in India, too, about respect or lack of it by American diplomats of Indian law. Now, this is not going to be settled by you and me debating it. It's going to be settled by people who know their business, sitting down, working their way through immunity regimes, arriving at a mutual acceptable understanding. We cannot have one definition of immunity for Indian diplomats in the United States and a completely different definition of immunity for American diplomats in India. So I think it is one of the, as I said, it's an issue we just need to work through.
Would you prefer to...
I think I'll stand. I think it's just
yeah,
easier.
Yeah, but would you prefer... I can call on people or you can...
Oh, I'll do that. I'll say you leave. Okay. All right, let's...
Thank you, Your Excellency. Welcome to the United States. Welcome back. We're glad to have you here. My name is Bajara Bohatba. I'm from Georgetown University, and I served at the U.S. Embassy in Delhi during this past summer. My question is regarding the balance that India is trying to do when it comes to its relation with Iran. You did mention that one of the priorities for India is the balance of global power. I do see diplomacy as more of a dance. So how do you see India trying to satisfy the United States or work with the United States while at the same time engaging with Iran in a constructive manner? Thank you.
Look, I think we are looking at what is happening between the United States and a group of other countries and Iran. Frankly, our hope is that the negotiations and the understandings that they are trying to reach would be successful. Because the fact is that if you ask a lot of countries, particularly those who live proximate to that region, what people want to see is a peaceful resolution of the differences. Nobody wants it to go any other way. So I don't think anybody wants to get caught between, you know, two different positions on that. So I think what our hope, and I think the hope of a lot of other countries, is that these negotiations really work out. Okay. It might be fairer if you recognize people.
I'm Michael Crapon at the Stimson Center. Welcome. My question is, how do you define responsible nuclear stewardship? In the United States, we've tried to define it to include diplomatic accomplishment. You've been to Beijing. Do you see any increased interest there in working nuclear risk reduction issues with India? And do you expect anything to happen on your watch here with Pakistan in this regard?
I think if I were to look at my period in Beijing, frankly, it was much more focused on managing the conventional risk reductions rather than the nuclear risk reductions. And believe me, that's much more challenging than you would think. What I think we did strive for was a much more predictable, stable, overall military and security relationship with China. And I don't think, conversations naturally move to the nuclear level simply because since both countries have no first-use policies and are very prudent about what they say and how they behave on that, that the occasions really arise. On the Pakistan issue, frankly, that's not my remit as ambassador. My remit is to build Indo-US relations. I'm sure someone else in our system is charged with talking to Pakistan, and I would let them do that job.
Hi, P.J. Crowley from George Washington University, formerly Assistant Secretary of State for Public Affairs. If I could pull you back to the Kobragati case, can you add some detail to your comment that the crisis should never have happened? If the United States notified India in September of the prospective case, was there an opportunity to resolve the case in that two-month period before the diplomat went into court? And did India try, in fact, to perhaps pursue the same kind of diplomatic solution that ultimately resolved the issue?
No, perhaps I didn't make myself clear. I said when I came to Washington, the sense I encountered here from other people was that this situation should have never happened. Having said that, I also feel this situation should have never happened. You mentioned the fact that there was some contact between the administration and us in September. Actually, there was a much earlier contact, I think in July, if I'm not mistaken, where we went to them on this case in July and asked for some information and some assistance. So it was already a subject of an ongoing discussion between us. The U.S. response in September was a response. It was not the first time the issue was raised. But having said that, look, my sense is that there are a number of issues which have come up as a result of this incident. One of it is an issue of immunity. How do we see each other's immunity? Another is an issue of privileges. What do we do? What should we be doing? What should we not be doing? I think there is also a basic issue of how diplomats are treated. I think that is a fact as well. I think what the way it was handled also had an impact on public opinion. But You know, frankly, having said that, I don't wish to go on and on about this. I think, you know, that we have a big relationship. We have what, by all accounts, is a fairly successful relationship. And my advice to anybody else who has any further questions on this is that leave the people who are dealing with this to deal with it. They're going to be sitting down and talking and working their way through this. And I'd be delighted to answer any other question on the broader relationship.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. Welcome to Washington. Raghubir Goyal from India Globe and Asia Today. My question is, last night, Mr. Ambassador, you must have been watching State of the Union from President Obama. What do you think about that? And second, being in Beijing in China, what do you think this $6 billion and plus more aid from the Chinese to the Pakistani nuclear, how dangerous is China for as far as India is concerned in the region? Thank you, sir.
Okay. Well, yes, I watched the State of the Union address, as I'm sure many of you did, and it was very interesting. Particularly, there were bits in it which were of very direct concern to us. The second question, I think the issue of what is the relationship between China and Pakistan is really something which we talk to the parties concerned in less public a manner than I would do if I were answering a question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ambassador. My name is Jared Engel. I'm a student at American University here in D.C. And I wanted to know, how does the growth of the Indian middle class play into increased U.S.-India trade and overall more Indians buying U.S. products and Americans buying Indian products? Thank you.
You know, this is my third speaking engagement for the day, and the one I came out of just now was the U.S.-India Business Council. My sense is, while I do emphasize that our trade has quadrupled since 2005, the fact is we really have a long way to go. When I look at the trade volumes that the U.S. has with other major economies, clearly there are sort of big possibilities here. But I think what we do need on both sides is a much more open business climate. The more you trade, the more problems you're going to have. And I don't think if you have trade problems as an ambassador, I'd actually call it a good thing, because I have trade problems when I have trade. The only way I won't have trade problems when I have no trade. To me, the fact that there are problems and issues, we need to work through those. Many of them do offer us possibilities of opening up new areas. I think one very important area which has got opened up is the possibility of India buying, sourcing its energy needs out of the United States. So one of our companies has signed two agreements for offtake of shale gas from the United States. Now, that is a really big deal, because if you look at, I think India is today probably the third largest energy importer in the world. And most of our energy comes, the coal part of it comes from east of India, but the oil part of it comes from the Gulf and that region. So something like, importing it from the United States is a development which has enormous ramifications for our economy. I think in this given situation, we couldn't really fully address economic issues so long as we had political and, regulatory impediments to doing so. And if I were to take you back to the nuclear deal, I think one very big... you must understand why we had the nuclear deal. I think one important driver was whenever we tried to do a certain thing with the U.S., we would come across the nuclear impediment. There would be a technology bar which on a sector which is quite unrelated, simply because the same technology could also be applied in the nuclear area or on the missile side. So I think we've cleared more or less the obstacles to doing business. Now that we have cleared the obstacles to doing business, it's time we did business. We have less excuse for not doing business. So now it so happened that we've come upon a globally tough time. And I think as global recovery improves, the possibility of doing business is going to grow. And I see less and less obstacles other than our own protectionism to doing business.
Thank you, Ambassador. Nilanthi Samaranayake from CNA. I wanted to ask you, I think, you know, over the past decade or so, there's a consensus that India-U.S. Navy relations, maritime relations are growing steadily. I wanted to ask you, at the outset of your term, what are some of the goals you have for building upon those Navy-to-Navy relations between the countries?
Well, some of my earliest meetings with the administration were actually with the Navy. I met both the Navy Secretary and the CNO. And, you know, they were probably among the more bullish meetings I had, because I think the Navy people are really all charged up about our relationship. And, you know, in the old days, we would say we exercise most with the U.S. Navy. I think today the U.S. Navy also exercises the most with us. And actually, you have an admiral sitting close by, so he would vouch for it. I think, again, there are great possibilities here, because part of it is that we today operate common platforms. Because we exercise so much, there is a, you know, we have very high degree of comfort levels. And these do make a difference. I mean, if you go back to the 2004 tsunami relief, I think while you know, it made political headlines, at the end of the day, it was a great testimony to the ability of the navies to work together. The fact that an admiral at this end picked up the phone and called an admiral at that end, and they put it all together. My sense is that if I were to look at the growth areas of our relationship, the ability and willingness to work together, because I do hear an America which wants a much more partnership-based sort of management of world security. So I think there are strong possibilities here. And this year we expect the Malabar exercise to take place, probably sometime the second half of the year. But more immediately, as I pointed out, we are going to be participating in the RIMPAC exercises. I think we're going to have naval forces there. So if you look year on year, I mean, I think our Navy-to-Navy cooperation has actually been growing very steadily.
Hi, thank you. Jim Berger from Washington Trade Daily. I just wanted to ask you how much a problem still exists over the business quota or business visa relationship, the entry of professionals into the U.S. market. I know India has been granted a bigger quota, but it's still, I guess, tentative. Is that a major problem, or
this is the H-1B you're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. I think it depends who you ask that question of. I think if you ask businesses, they would say it's never enough. But we have a concern, though, on that, which is that as part of the immigration reform, there is a bill from the Senate which defines a category called H-1B dependent employer. That is anybody, I think, who has more than 15%, which is a very, very low threshold. And then economically, you know, and then disadvantages that employer, because there are a lot of things that company cannot offer a lot of services. So what it does is, in many ways, it basically attacks the business model which a lot of Indian companies, not just Indian companies, have in the U.S. Now, we think this is a bad idea. We think it's a bad idea because, of course, it affects our business interests, so we think it's a bad idea. But it also is a bad idea for U.S. business, because I think if you don't have these Indian companies, these are the companies which keep U.S. companies operating 24/7. They sharpen their competitiveness, and their absence is actually going to hurt the U.S. economy as well. So we are hoping that as the Someone asked me about the State of the Union. So one thing I did pick up is that sentiment is today moving towards early progress on the immigration reform. So I hope that as part of this, something much more balanced, something much fairer comes out of the House deliberations on this. And this, frankly, for us is a very important priority because I think, at least in India, it would shape very much the Indian perception of how open is the U.S. economy.
Daniel Moro, Johns Hopkins University. Going back to the international cooperation on the Navy side in the anti-piracy operation in the Indian Ocean, there was a very bad episode involving the Italian and the Indian authorities, and you still keep two Italian Marines since more than 2 years inside your country without saying exactly for what they are accused. The question is, provided that India is becoming more and more important on the international arena, and we all need you, how do you think is the best solution for this, which is a quite, in my opinion, embarrassing case? Thank you.
Embarrassing to the Italians or embarrassing for us?
The international community.
Okay.
When you keep someone in prison or in jail for 2 years without telling what is going to, without a trial, the embarrassment is in any civilized country, in New York, as in New Delhi, as in Rome.
Well, I think my understanding is that the process is moving towards a finalization of the charges. And my sense is that the situation is somewhat more complicated than your question suggested, which is that, what charges to bring. People know what these people are charged with. They're charged with opening fire and killing fishermen. So there's no confusion on what the issue at heart is. I think the debate was under what law to try them and how to try them, and then there were some discussions between us and the Italians. So my sense of it is that it is moving along. And certainly I don't think there's any desire on our part to complicate larger anti-piracy efforts. In fact, we contribute to it in many ways by working with other navies and doing things ourselves in the Gulf, off Somalia and the Gulf of Aden.
Ambassador, thank you. I am Major Jen Hinkle from Department of Defense. I have two related questions. The first question was related to your comment on how you think the look east may need to match up in some way to the United States' rebalance to Asia. So my question is, how do you see India taking leadership in an increasingly volatile Asia and working with the U.S. to maintain stability? And the second question is kind of related. How do you see the strategic relationship between India, China, and the U.S.? And specifically, because of your unique role having worked in all three capitals, what do you see your role in maintaining that strategic triangle?
The look east meets rebalancing. In a sense, I said something which could answer it. I said, if we could be ourselves, I think it would be good. We are doing the look east because it's something which works for us. Today, more than half our foreign trade is from east of India. If you look at the natural resources flow into India, a lot of it is from countries like Indonesia and Australia, our biggest trade partners. I think if you take perhaps the top 10 trade partners, four of them are to the east of India, China, Japan, Korea, Singapore. So if you look at India's stakes east of India, that's actually been a dramatic shift in the last 20 years. And a lot of the look east is driven by the stakes we have, by our investments, in a lot of these countries we have Indians settled there as well. So there's its own internal Indian logic to what is happening. What is, in terms of the U.S. rebalancing, if you're from the Department of Defense, you know better than me what is the logic of that. Now, the question is, if we are both doing our own thing, to what extent does it intersect and, you know, where is it that we can work together? And I think we have interests here. We have interests in ensuring that freedom of navigation is protected. We have interests in ensuring that, anti-piracy operations are conducted. You can have a tsunami-like situation where we do humanitarian operations together. So I think once you have a political and military comfort level, and we are both, we're coming into a zone, each one from a different direction, but with a high degree of harmony and comfort, we will find things to do. That's the kind of scenario I see there. On the India, China, U.S., you could have a whole seminar on that, and I'm not sure I want to be the guy who conducts it, because the fact is, we have our own, we have a particular relationship with China. There's a lot, I can speak at length on the good parts of it. There are challenges in that relationship as well. I mean, among them, the fact that we have a border on which, we do not have an agreement. So we have certain problems which are specific to us and the Chinese, which are not necessarily issues which directly relate to the United States. I'm sure you have issues as well with the Chinese. And some of it can impinge on us, or maybe not. But I think what I would say is that today we do see the United States as a stabilizing power in Asia, a power whose presence we value. When we look at the larger, because Asia is a region whose security architecture is still very much under evolution. So we're going to have a long transition period where, people are going to sort of push and nudge and, get to positions which work for everybody. So I think in this long transition period, when you have two important players who have broadly a convergence of interests and a comfort level in working together, I think it's important that those two players should do so.
My name is Walter Anderson, and I'm at SAIS, and welcome to Washington. I actually wanted to pursue that previous question. The previous speaker mentioned India, China, and the U.S. I want to go a little to the east and mention the other triangle of interest, India, Japan, and the U.S. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear your view of where that strategic relationship might be going. And I think of the Japanese interest, I think, and your interest at least at the symbolic level, Mr. Abe, was the invited guest at the recent Republic Day ceremony. I understand the Japanese are prepared to invest up to $90 billion in your trillion-dollar investment over the next 5 years. And the Emperor of Japan was in India, a month and a half ago. So where do you see that relationship going with Japan?
Well, where I would hope to see that relationship going is upwards. I think it's a relationship which has a promise which it has not really delivered on for many, many years. And it now looks as though it's really on the move. And the fact that we had a visit, it's symbolic, but it's extremely important that we had a visit of the Emperor and Empress of Japan, and we recently had Prime Minister Abe as our chief guest for the Indian Republic Day. These are signs that it's moving. In terms of where that relationship could be, well, I've done 5 years of my career in Japan, and these were not the easiest years to do because this was during the time when we had a nuclear test. But I think we've come a long way since then. There are now serious Japanese plans to Japanese diplomacy on the whole has been very much more active in the last year and a half. I think a lot of those energies are now getting directed at India, but they are to some extent building on things which were already there in India. I mean, we have this big project called the Delhi-Mumbai Industrial Corridor, which is to build both a freight corridor and build industrial townships across a length of almost 1,000 miles. So you have, I think, a big Japanese outward push, and much of that, or some of that at least, is coming into India. And I think on our side, we are trying to make sure that this time we get it right, that we are able to meet many of their expectations. You can see the Japanese now move on beyond the Delhi-Mumbai Industrial Corridor to activities in the south between Bangalore and Chennai. I think beyond the economics, there are other areas where the Japanese have shown interest, and we reciprocate that interest. There was a question on the Navy. We have invited the Japanese to join the Malabar exercise. We are actually discussing with the Japanese the possibility of buying an aircraft, aircraft called US-2 from a Japanese company. So I think that's one. If I were to look at this evolving Asian architecture, I think one relationship I would look at for the next few years quite closely, I would monitor, is the one between India and Japan, because that one I can safely predict is going to really grow in the years to come.
If I may, could I ask you a question about U.S.-Indian relations?
Please. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I'm Charles Wessner from the National Academy of Sciences, and it's a pleasure to see you here, Mr. Ambassador. I'd simply like to ask how you see the science, technology, and innovation relationship, where I don't see a major issue, but I'd like to understand how we might expand that, and including perhaps the relationships of our universities. There's been a great surge outward from our universities to try and help the world compete with us. And we would like to hear more how you might see that in both senses.
You know, I think Jessica and I were having this conversation before we walked into this room about what could Indian and American institutions do with each other. And a point I made to her was that if you were a super optimist on the relationship, you should either remember the last 10 years or you should remember the last 60 years. Because if you go back, if you look at our many of our key institutions, the Institutes of Technology or our agricultural research institutes, you know, a lot of these actually have their origins. Some of our research, you know, other research institutes, they have their origins in collaboration between India and American universities. And in terms of, I would say, our priorities, the last few years, we've really invested much more on upgrading the level of education in India. I think people do realize that while the economy has grown, the HR quality, the HR quantity and HR quality have not grown commensurately. And I think if we look at issues like innovation and patenting, we clearly lag behind. So there's considerable appetite to work with American institutions because, you know, at the end of the day, you are the folks we are most comfortable with. And there's history there. Now, I think the challenge is how to get it done. We'll have to look at different models. I know that already there are some moves to see how foreign universities can open campuses in India. But there are many universities who don't want to do that. So for them, we'll have to see if we can come up with models where a much more collaborative way of working works out. Then you could have institutions like yours and, you know, people like CSIR or Indian Academy, or even in some cases private sector, who have an interest in working on innovation. I think when you, as I said, to me, it is like We've cleared the obstacles, you know, in our relationship. Okay? So there's nothing which actually today prevents us from moving forward unless it's our own energy levels, our own caution, our own risk aversion. These are today, to me, the obstacles. I think anybody who's willing to push through that open door, I'm willing to help you push through it alongside. So I do hope, you know, I think it's something we need to have a conversation in due course.
Thank you, Mr. Ambassador, and welcome again to Washington. The next big push,
Please introduce yourself.
Is that better? I'm Rajesh Kadian. The next big push, I would think, would be the renewal of the lease on Diego Garcia, for instance, which comes up in 2 years. Now, if India was to offer a lease of an island to the U.S. Navy, would you comment on that hypothetical possibility? And secondly, the role of the Indian-American community in the growth of our rising relationship between India and the United States.
Well, I think the short answer to your first question is no. The second question, I'm prepared to talk at greater length. I cannot think of any big foreign policy relationship for India which has been, where the Indian, the hyphenated community has played such an important role. I mentioned that in the body of my remarks because the present state of relations have really been made possible by a whole lot of things coming together. And when I first came to the U.S., I think perhaps in 1982, okay, and the community was much smaller. Frankly, the image of the community was much different. I think today, when the average American's impression of India is very much shaped by the interactions they have with members of the Indian American community, and frankly, I think that reflects very, very well on India. So I will say my thank yous to the community next weekend when I'm meeting them.
Mr. Ambassador, you've been very generous in answering a huge range of questions. I wondered if I could just wrap up by asking you about your personal priorities. Anybody in government or in any diplomatic posting is at the mercy of events, mm-hmm. and usually ends up spending most of their time on things they didn't anticipate. But given that, can you share with us what are your, as if you look back on this posting, what are your personal goals for how you would hope to be, what two or three issues you would most hope to be advancing? Maybe you suggested on the education question one of them.
I think in, my wife would tell you if she were here that I don't have much of a life outside office. I mean, my personal goals in that sense are half work, half personal life goals. I think the three areas which interest me most, one, having, studied at a university for some length of time, having interacted with think tanks, including yours, for many, many years. I think that whole education, it actually at the lowest level starts from skills, where we have huge problems in skills generation in India. The fact that companies are not able to get workers of the right skills. From skills up to education, up the ladder to policy making, I think there's a huge space there where it's possible for us to work together to mutual advantage. So I think whether it is the Carnegie footprint extending to New Delhi, or whether it is an American university which wants to find a way of getting into India, or whether it's existing institutions working on it, or whether it's even on the, to get companies to train and equip their workers and managers better. I think there's an enormous space, and it's something which really interests me, because I think I think that's really, frankly, what would change India. The second area, I've had personally a long history with our military. In fact, it's a multi-generational history. I've had a grandfather here who came to source U.S. equipment. Then my father, in a few years later, did the same. I could say perhaps I did it a bit more successfully than they did. But I think getting the militaries to work together is something which I regard as, it's something which I take a personal interest in. And I do think it's a very important priority for my country. And the third is really, it's a sort of Calvin Coolidgean saying about the business of America being business. But I think the business of our relationship has to be business. You know, if we don't get business going between India and the U.S., I think our relationship has a glass ceiling. If we really have, we keep talking about taking it to new levels. You know, at the end of the day, I like to see it in numbers. And if we can get good numbers out there, I think we've got a great relationship.
I think this session has kind of broken new ground for diplomatic candor and patience in as I said, answering a huge range of questions. I hope that the rest of your time here will be as productive for all of us as this session has been. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.